Super Cali Fragilistic Expialidocious.
That's not a word.
Of course it's a word. And unless I'm very much mistaken, I think it's going to prove to be a rather useful one. When trying to express oneself, it's frankly quite absurd to leaf through lengthy lexicons to find the perfect word. A little spontaneity keeps conversation keen. You need to find a way to say precisely what you mean. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 20th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a writer. You can see his writing at the Newark Star Ledger, also at Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, on Critcherland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You could see his photography at followspotphoto.com. You could see his photography and his writing at broadwaystars.com. He also writes for such outlets like Arts America and the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
All righty. It's a beautiful, beautiful Sunday, isn't it? At least here in New York it is.
We're I haven't been out.
You haven't been out? You're in the darkness there?
Yes. That's my policy on Sundays.
But it is a great spring afternoon, and everybody is talking about the Tony Awards and all the other award seasons that we're wrapped up in. But let's go back to the theater for just a brief discussion about the show, The Common Pursuit. Peter, why don't you get us started there?
Well, this is Downstairs at the Roundabout, and it is about, it's very much like Merrily We Roll Along in a certain way, because it is about people who idealistically start a counterculture newspaper and are very enthusiastic about doing so. There's your standard, very serious character. There's your very flighty character who doesn't seem very grounded, and but the guy who starts the magazine seems to have a great deal of integrity, and it's basically I guess I'm sounding already like I didn't like it all that much, I thought it was okay because it went in the direction that I expected it to go. That as time went on, these people would lose their ideals and that they would compromise themselves tremendously. As a result, the set from the first act to the second act changes a good deal because by selling out, so to speak, their offices become that much more impressive because they're making money now. And with the inevitable making of money comes other types of corruptions as well, betrayals. And that's what happens in The Common Pursuit. Simon Gray's the playwright. It was first done in this country back in 1986, and I did see it at the much lamented Promenade Theater, which we don't have anymore, on Broadway in the 70s. Another one of those off-Broadway theaters that succumbed to real estate. So it's an okay evening. I will say that the people in it are effective, if not brilliant. Moises Kaufman directed them. Who did I enjoy? Well, all of them, really. The woman, Kristen Bush, plays a character named Marigold. And, of course, when you have one woman in the middle of five men, you're going to have a good deal of consternation going on because men are going to be interested in her. Maybe not all of them, but certainly quite a few of them. And that's a good deal of the play. So I wish I could be more I just don't have much to say because it made so little of an impression on me. And I only saw it a few nights ago. But it started, it continued, it ended. I went home and I didn't give it another thought. So I wish I could be more enthusiastic. It certainly was never painful. It certainly was never what are they thinking. It was just a case where I thought it was okay.
Michael, what did you think about this? I would agree. It's one of those plays that I went in cold. I'd never seen it or read it before. It became more interesting to me as it went along. I suppose that's a good sign, and I enjoyed Act Two better than Act One. I guess because it's cumulative to the extent that you see the way these people are. You know, the way they're changing or not changing, and the way their relationships are growing or not growing over a period of several years. And I found it interesting that, oh, here's an interesting thing, Peter, did you notice when I went, the title page, I guess that's the word, of the playbill, the page that has the cast on it, the cast list on it, and then underneath it has the you know, the breakdown of the scenes, there was a label like posted over the breakdown of the scenes. So I was wondering if they made any changes in terms of where the intermission was. Or also, someone said that who I went with, who had seen it before, I think they weren't sure if that was that epilogue flashback always there as presented here, or was that done differently?
I don't remember what happened in 1986, but I have every reason to believe that the epilogue was always there. It would seem to me the logical way to end this play, because we do come full circle. We come back to where they started. You see them idealistically. I mean, really, there is a merrily parallel there in that sense.
And also, isn't it Plenty? Plenty has a scene like that at the very. I think that's the only time in Plenty, the stage version, not the movie. After she's gone through all this stuff, that then right at the very end, if I recall, you see her before anything happened as a idealistic, hopeful person, and it's very effective in all cases, I think. So. Do you remember that from Plenty, Peter?
I never saw Plenty.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. Mm. Oh, and the stage version was seemed to me quite different from the movie. I hope you get to see a production of it someday. It's not very likely, I suppose. But anyway, yeah, they do that. They do the same thing. I thought it was a good production acting-wise. I thought the sets were very good. I was particularly impressed with Kieran Campion, even though his accent didn't sound 100% perfect to me. But he gave a very interesting portrayal of the guy who's supposed to be, well, he's certainly the most successful writer among all of them, but I think they all kind of think of him as a hack. You know, somebody who's kind of sells out. So there again is a merrily parallel, isn't there? Yeah. I thought he brought a lot of depth to that, because he, just the way he played a very kind of guy who seems very superficial and very kind of, you know, commercial, but there was interesting things going on with, you know, very interesting things going on with his character. And another interesting character is the one who is gay, but there's really not too much made of that. It's just sort of, it's not discussed. It's just sort of alluded to for most of the play. And then, but then it, at the end, it becomes quite an issue in one sense or another. So I thought that was all very interesting. You know, you have to look at these plays, especially in the context of when they were written.
Absolutely.
I think it might have been, you know, it might have been even better with a better production. But I couldn't actually fault. I couldn't really fault anyone involved. It just I'm not sure exactly why it took a while for me to get into it. But then once I did, I really enjoyed it. I was very glad I saw it.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a great play. I definitely agree with you that one must always look at the time when a play is written, and certainly take what was going on at that time and the way people were thinking at that time into consideration. I find that very valuable. I do not believe in the term dated, that a play is dated. I look at it as a time machine, that here is a way to find out where people were and what they were thinking at that time. So if I watch Sunday in New York, the movie, and it deals with the fact that Jane Fonda, who's about, I don't know, 25 to 30 in the picture, something like that, is still struggling with her virginity. I don't say, my God, I mean, please, women go to bed when they're children. No, that's now. Back then, this was an issue. I mean, so, and it was. So, so you find out, gee, look where we were at that period of time.
Right.
Look where we are now. It may be better, it may be worse, but we have the opportunity to see what people were thinking. And I find it very, very valuable, the type of stuff you don't quite find in the history books that really tell us a great deal about who we were and to some degree what we've become.
Absolutely. I think what some people mean when they say dated is that they, you know, happily in most cases, things have changed so that things, you know, certain perceptions and certain outlooks of the, those days are just not acceptable now. So on the one hand, it is absolutely imperative, I agree with you, to see what those were. But that doesn't mean that people today can accept them in the way that they were. I was just thinking of this actually just yesterday because I was listening to Carmen Jones. The Oscar Hammerstein musical based on Bizet's Carmen. And I love it overall. I think it's a lot of the lyrics are just absolutely incredible. And it's a very interesting very clever adaptation, the way it, you know, the setting was changed to a parachute factory during World War II in America. But there are certain things in it that would not be – that are dated in terms of perhaps the way that people – you know, that the – African-American characters are depicted.
To be fair with this, let me say, you know, you're talking about something like DAT, D-A-T.
Well, yeah, I mean,
for
that. Yes.
And
yes.
To be fair, and by the way, of course, yes, you're right. But the thing is, let's also remember that Hammerstein did that with his other characters as well. Geraniums in the Winder.
Oh,
you know,
yes, absolutely.
You know, so it wasn't that he was picking on black people and really stressing that. The New England accents in Carousel, the Midwestern Southern accents in Oklahoma, those are actually written in the script as well. So he liked doing that.
He also was not by any means the only person who did that with black dialect. One of the huge problems that people had with Porgy and Bess over the years is that it was written in that, you know, dare's a boat, dat's leaving soon for New York.
Sure, sure.
You know, if you just cut that out and change nothing else, I think that helps people a lot in terms of...
I agree.
You know, because it's just a convention of the time that has not worn well. You know, and I find that fascinating, actually, that people used to feel it necessary to actually try to write the dialect into the, you know, the pronunciation of the dialect into the script. And I'm not even saying that it's completely inaccurate, but there's just something about the way that it looks on the page. It just really,
you bet,
just really rankles. You know?
Of course.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys about Moises Kaufman. Why do you think he took this project? It seems to be out of the type of genre that he does.
I was wondering the same thing, James. Yeah. I think he's been more trying to branch out lately. Though, is this the first case we know of where he directed a revival?
Let's see. Bengal Tiger, 33 Variations, I Am My Own Wife. Those are all originals. Gross Indecency.
I think it may be the first time. So I think is that what you meant? Because that struck me. Yeah.
Well, it seems that... to me, that the shows that he has undertaken have been have had strong messages in them, and it doesn't seem as though this one is. It doesn't seem like he would put his imprimatur upon it.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he may want to branch out.
I think it's
time to do something different. I remember when I was interviewing Laura Benanti, she said, "I really want to do a play because I want to do something different." Yeah, you know, and then she did.
She did the Vibrator Room. Yeah.
Well, actually, ironically enough, the one she did after she did this, she didn't stay with, and that was the Violet Hour. But nevertheless, right. I mean, you know, people just want to do different things. You know, I mean, Sondheim, who wrote a song called I Never Do Anything Twice, rarely has. I mean, it's amazing when you look at his career, how so many times what he has done has been completely different from other things. So I think people want to do that, and I'm not surprised. And I think that he should say, let me see what I can do with a script that is more than 25 years old, that doesn't get done, that nobody gives a thought to, and speaks to me. Yeah, so so good for him.
Well, also, when he did, James, you may recall, when he did 33 Variations, I think some people then commented that it was different than what he had done
before.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Because, you know, his first couple of things were with his Tectonic Theater mm-hmm. company that were involved, whatever you call it, documentary theater, just going out and interviewing company members, going out and interviewing people. Well, that was the case with the Matthew Shepard play.
The Laramie Project.
Right. But and then Gross Indecency was, I mean, obviously somewhat different. Those people were all dead. But that was based on transcripts of the trials. Mm-hmm. And so those two were very similar in that way. But then 33 Variations was, you know, was just a play, you know.
Sure.
So I guess, yeah, I do think he's, you know, very wisely trying to show that he's just doesn't only do one thing.
And Michael, I don't know if you or Peter have been to the Roundabout Theater Company's website where the Common Pursuit page is up, but they show these five boys standing there in prep school outfits, and it makes me think about a comment that you had mentioned about Matt Kavanaugh and Mitt Romney. You want to delve into that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, as we all know, Mitt Romney has gotten a lot of publicity lately about this horrendous bullying incident that he apparently led when he was in prep school. And because of that, I've seen several photos of him lately when he was a very young man. And it struck me that he looks very, very much like Matt Kavanaugh. Or vice versa. And so that really struck me. I mean, if you Google image Mitt Romney young or Mitt Romney student, you might be quite shocked at how much he looks like Matt Kavanaugh. So I'm thinking that maybe, you know, Matt might pursue that as a, you know, some kind of a project, depending on.
If somebody wrote a fringe play, you know, about Mitt Romney's haircut or something like that, you know, they could cast Matt right there. Right there.
I mean, it's really, you check it out. It's really amazing how much he looks like him.
All righty. So, Peter was one to. What did you do? I think that you, was it for Mother's Day or erstwhile, you went to go see Mary Poppins?
Well, the reason I went to Mary Poppins is because I'm doing this book about every musical that was nominated for Best Musical but lost. Mary Poppins fits. It didn't win that year. So I went. Now, the thing becomes, when you go to see Mary Poppins in the umpteenth year of its run, who do you call up and say, hey, do you want to see Mary Poppins? I don't know anybody who may, in my circle, who may want to go. So I asked my girlfriend, I said, do you know anybody who's got a kid that I can take? And yes, so I wound up taking a five-year-old girl. And her mother and father came to the theater. And the little girl, the idea of going to see Mary Poppins struck her as a wonderful idea until she got there. And really, she realized she was going to have to go with this stranger into this theater. And so that was kind of funny. You know, she started crying. She was clutching the mother's leg. But as soon as I said, you know, we don't have to do this. It's no, I'm talking to the mother now. We don't have to do this. It's no problem. Don't feel bad. You know, I mean, it's fine. You know, take her home. That's fine. At that moment, the kid just made a commitment to going to see this show. I am telling you, I mean, she walked in as if she owned the New Amsterdam. It was so amazing. And it was just so wonderful to see a kid transfixed. It hasn't happened to me in a long time to watch a kid whose face was just aglow and never did her eyes ever leave the stage. Now, frankly, if I were a better person, I would have leaned over to her at every moment and said, "Now that's the father," and you know, and done all that kind of stuff. I didn't for two reasons. I had my own agenda. I had to take notes. I mean, I have this book to write, you know. So I had to let the kid be on her own. And secondly, there are people around us, you know, and it's annoying when somebody does that, you know. I mean, who wants to hear that, you know? So I just thought, let it wash over the kid. I had no idea whether or not the kid was getting a little, a lot, none, everything. I just had no idea. And we had made arrangements that the parents would come at intermission just on the off chance that the kid might say, "I've had enough," or "I don't like it," or "I don't like you," or "You're not telling me anything," or whatever, you know.
"I don't
you're
like
not giving
you.
Me anything." Yeah, right. So the parents showed, and the kid said, "No, I want to see it all." So we went back, same story, eyes never left the stage. And it was so, one thing I didn't do, and I purposely didn't do, was I did not say to the kid, "Now you must clap after every number." I did not want to do that. I wanted to see if she would pick that up on her own and what would happen there. So while I applauded after every number, I did not tell her to. And it was really fascinating to watch her not applaud at first, catch on, understand what the, I'll put this in quotation marks, responsibility was. But by the end, that applause was bigger, louder, more forceful, and she was on her own. I mean, she was really reacting to it. And I got teary-eyed because the idea of a kid seeing her first Broadway show and that type of show is really something to see. So I really grooved on that part of it. The other thing is the kid wrote me a thank you note, and the kid's five, six years old, something like that. And I mean, I was amazed at the thank you note that was so detailed with Mary Poppins written on the front with the picture of Mary with the umbrella. But inside, the kid actually wrote the word supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and just wrote, there wasn't a mistake at all in any of the letters, you know, how to start a letter and then have to scribble it out and start again or anything like that. No, I mean, you know, so this kid's a really bright kid. Now, by the way, for anybody who's interested in Mary Poppins, let me say that it's in terrific shape. If Mary Poppins is the show you want to see and you fear the time has passed it by, it has not. For one thing, Gavin Lee is in it and is still quite wonderful as Bert. Also, the new woman who's playing it, somebody new to me named Stephanie Lee, is quite fine and reminded me a great deal of Ashley Brown, who started the role. But it was fun to see so many people who I've seen in shows along the way, like Jonathan Freeman is in the show now playing the bank chairman. I don't know if he was with it from the beginning. I don't recall his being in it. James Hindman, an actor I like very, very much, plays some minor parts. And Tom Cerata, who I've known since he was at NYU, is in it as well. And it was just fun to see. When you go to a show and you don't know, you haven't looked at the playbill, you know, because I'm watching the kid, I'm getting the kid a booster seat. You know, I'm busy, you know, so I'm not looking at the playbill. And then you see people on stage that you know. It's always such fun when that happens. But it's in very good shape. So anybody who feels that you'd see a tired, out-of-gas production, it is not true. Again, it may not be everybody's favorite musical. It's certainly not mine, frankly. I mean, I think I've never responded to this character. I think Mary Poppins is quite a cold woman, and I don't like her at all. I like her more in this musical than I do in the original movie. I know that's heresy, but I mean, she really plays mind games with those kids sometimes. I mean, do you remember before they all jump into the sidewalk paintings that Bert does and Jolly Holiday, and later she like denies to the kids that that ever happened. This story is very strange to me, and how it ever got the popularity it has is beyond me. I do not understand it. But anyway, and do you remember in the movie the Ed Wynn character who loves to laugh, and you know, and everybody's just enjoying laughing so much, and she's just not amused at all. I mean, yeah, and why not? What's wrong with laughing? You know. So anyway, well, but. Anyway, if you like Mary Poppins and you saw the show a long time ago and feared if you went back, the magic wouldn't be there, I dare say it's as good as it was when it opened.
Well, Peter, knowing that you are single-handedly saving Broadway one child at a time,
that's right,
is inspirational to all of us out there. Do you think it's an experience that we should all undertake? Everybody should grab a child, perhaps absolutely with the permission of the parents, of course, and take them to a Broadway show.
You bet. I mean, you know, it's funny. Because the kid was so unnerved at the beginning, we didn't go in until after 8 o'clock. I thought, you know, we got there at 7:45. That was when we agreed to meet. And it was a case that I expected we'd go in, you know, and I'd have plenty of time to talk to her. I was going to say to the kid, do you even understand, you know, that you're going to see real people up there as opposed to seeing a movie? You know, I was going to have that conversation with her. But she was so gun shy about going in that I said, we might as well stay out here until we really have to go in. You know, I mean, let her be with the parents, you know, and also 15 minutes worth of the parents talking to me and where, you know, I mean, I'd met the parents before at a party, but I thought it was a good idea to wait. So I have no idea if the kid even knew what she was going to be seeing in terms of real people versus film. I imagine her parents did take care of that beforehand. But what I did find out, what the kid did say to me at intermission was that Natalie and she mentioned a whole slew of names, meaning schoolmates who had seen it. And I think one of the reasons she wanted to go is because she wanted to be with the in crowd and be able to say, I saw Mary Poppins too, you know. And probably, by the way, from better seats than they did. But
you know, what's interesting to me is that you said this girl was about 5 or 6 people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that is, you know, I mean, that's pretty young for theater. And I guess it's important to note that not every child that age is necessarily ready for it. But I'm really glad to hear that this one apparently really was.
Again, I wouldn't take it to the common pursuit, you know.
well, that too.
You know, so, but you know, you have to wonder too about certain things. You know, I mean, like there is, after all, those almost nude statues coming to life in Mary Poppins, and you know, I wonder if the kid was going to shriek. You know, I mean.
Well, and there was also, if you recall, there was a lot of publicity when it opened, I guess mostly from Michael Riedel, about how several parts of the show were perceived by him anyway as being inappropriate for children, especially young children, notably the temper number,
mm-hmm.
Where, it, you know, I mean, it does seem like it might be disturbing to young children, but I guess everyone's different, you know, and maybe it is disturbing to some children, but did you get the impression that this child was disturbed by that scene?
Not for a second.
No.
Not for a second. The kid really was just mesmerized. That really is the word. So,
and it's also it's quite a long show.
It is. And I'm when that kid came out of the theater at the end, I mean, she threw herself onto her mother's shoulder and I think went promptly to sleep. I mean, she really was overtaxed because, yeah, that is a problem of it. It is 2:45, you know, and that is a lot for, I mean, I'm sure this girl goes to bed at night much earlier than 10:45. I don't know for sure, of course, but that seems to be a reasonable guess.
What do you guys think about these the 7 p.m. shows instead of the 8 p.m. shows?
Terrific.
I love them.
Oh,
I think it's great.
Especially it's nice as, you know, that they're staggered from between 7 and 8 because this way you can make your choice of what you prefer. Alex Cohen, the producer, used to have what he called the 9 o'clock theater because he liked to loll over dinner at a restaurant and just take his time and not have to worry. So he used to start shows at, not all of them, but I mean, he had a division of his organization called the 9 o'clock theater. Michael, do you remember this? Does this ring a bell to you?
Yes.
So I mean, you know, but it's nice when shows used to start at 8:30. Back in the 70s, they decided, well, that's too late, so let's go to 7:30. And then people thought that was too early, and that's when we started going at 8 o'clock in the mid to late 70s. But it is nice to have staggered performances so that people can make that decision. On the other hand, have you ever been to a 7 o'clock show where you haven't seen 7:45 people coming in late into the aisles because they thought it was an 8 o'clock show? I mean,
yeah.
That's inevitable, you know, so that is the downside of that.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I mean, I have mixed feelings. I guess there's nothing wrong with having them at different times, but it does. I guess people have to just get into their heads that they have to really double and triple check the time on the performance that they are attending. I may have mentioned recently, I've gotten at least two press releases that had to be corrected later by the press agent because they got the time wrong. Mm. And if that, you know, that if they're getting it wrong, then that indicates that, you know, that's and there was one particular case, and I can't actually remember the show at the moment, but there were three nights in a row where the show was at three different times. If I recall, there was the Wednesday evening when it was at 8, and then the next night it was at 7, and then the following night it was at 7:30. So, I mean, maybe that's a little too inconsistent. I don't know, but I suppose it's fine as long as everyone makes it a point to check.
And I think with the theater tickets being so outrageously expensive as they are now, people would check and make sure. You know, I mean, there's that famous episode of I Love Lucy, of course, where Lucy goes to the Most Happy Fella, you know, and they're sitting at the table having dinner. And Lucy says, Ethel, what time is it? And Ethel says something like 6:30. And Lucy says, too late for the matinee, huh? You know, so because their tickets were the afternoon. And whoever thought, by the way, what they wind up doing, if you may recall the episode, is the fact that Lucy and Ethel see the first act and Ricky and Fred will see the second act. But the irony is that Lucy and Ethel, second act. I mean, they decide to come in at intermission. They see no reason why they shouldn't. And to think that the concept of second acting was actually introduced to the public back in the late 50s on I Love Lucy show is hilarious to me. By the way, anybody who's interested in second acting, Mary Poppins, forget it. They check your tickets as you leave to go outside. They scan them. And then they scan them when you come back in again. So there's no fooling around at Mary Poppins. This may be true of everywhere. I don't know, but I don't think so. But it really is a police state when it comes to checking tickets over there.
That's very interesting, the scanning on the way out and scanning on the way back in so they know who didn't return.
Yeah, right.
And they can actually do some studies about that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they know a lot about you.
Yeah, right. Well, it's true of all of us in this internet age, sure. So,
well, you know. You do. A lot of people are very concerned about their privacy, and that's interesting. I wonder if folks have thought about that. It could really cause quite a dogfight. Oh, dogfight.
Ah.
So.
Thank you, James.
Dogfight is coming up at Second Stage with writers who are two of our favorites. Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about Dogfight? We haven't seen it yet, but it's coming up.
I know beans about Dogfight, but I do know that Benj Pasek and Justin Paul are two writers that I admire terrifically. I saw one of their shows at the White Plains Performing Arts Center a couple of years ago. It was their thesis project when they were at the University of Michigan, one of our finest musical theater schools, and I liked it immeasurably. But then I went to see A Christmas Story during its tech rehearsal in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Boy, that's a sentence you don't hear very much. The tech rehearsal at Hershey, Pennsylvania. I only saw the first act, but I did get the cast album and adored it. They are writers who can write both in a modern vein and a traditional vein, and they seem very comfortable at both. So, by the way, this week I'll be in Rochester, New York, judging a contest, and John Bolton, who was the leading man of Christmas Story and also was the critic in Curtains, Daryl Grady, and I also saw him go on the week that David Hyde Pierce was out, and he was terrific as Frank Chiaffi, the detective. So it's going to be fun to spend some time with John Bolton. But I'll tell you, this is the team that I believe in most for the future of the American musical, because they want to make sure that words rhyme correctly and that the stresses are on the right syllable, which, you know, may sound finicky to a lot of people, but I guarantee you an audience feels much more at ease when words rhyme, because it's just more pleasant to the ear and they can follow the story better. Because we all know that when you go to a Broadway musical, you do not understand every lyric, and don't tell me you do not, because it's very hard. So rhyme helps that. So I really admire these two young guys. They're still in their early 20s, I believe. And to think the fact that they've done so well to have this Christmas show that I have a feeling we're going to see on Broadway this year. And here they are at the very prestigious Playwrights Horizon working with Joe Mantello. I mean, what a thrill. Isn't this wonderful for these guys? And so I wish them tremendously well. And I am counting the days like a kid till Christmas, till Dogfight happens.
It's at Second Stage.
Is that right?
Yeah,
okay. I better not go to the wrong theater, and I better be at the right time too.
Yeah, and it's,
yeah,
I'll
check my tickets. So the very
prestigious Second Stage.
Yes, the first performance is Wednesday, the 27th of June at 8 p.m. They are going with the 8 p.m. performances.
I can't tell you how many times I checked for this Mary Poppins performance, because after making a big deal of taking this kid, imagine getting there and missing half the show, you know, that started at 7. Oh, did I check? You know, I wasn't going to be embarrassed in that way. So. Second Stage. I love Second Stage. Good for them. Good for them for doing this.
So let me, Michael, did you mention that this was based on a River Phoenix movie?
Yes, I do not. I am not familiar with the work.
Well, let me read this summary here from Second Stage's website. It's November 21st, 1963, on the eve of their deployment to a small but growing conflict in Southeast Asia. Three young Marines set out for one final boys' night of debauchery, partying, and maybe a little bit of trouble. Is that Miss Saigon? But when Corporal Eddie Birdlace meets Rose, an awkward and idealistic waitress, he enlists to win a cruel bet with his fellow recruits. She rewrites the rules of the games and teaches him the power of compassion. Two-time Tony Award winner Joe Mantello, Wicked and Other Desert Cities Assassins, directs this world premiere musical.
All right. November 21st, 1963, you said, right?
Yes, November.
That's a Thursday.
Note the date.
Yeah.
That's a Thursday, because on Friday the world changed, and I guess that's part of the point of this, because that's when the Kennedy assassination happened. Uh-huh. So that's very interesting. It's funny, a friend of mine, Howard Rogat, was just writing me. He said, would you refresh my memory of what happened on Saturday, November 23rd, 1963? What had happened was he was going to the musical Jenny, starring Mary Martin. And before the show, Mary Martin came out and said to everybody, essentially, this is not a quotation, but, you know, look, we've all been through a lot. Let's try to do the best we can and having a good time today. But the memory does play tricks. And he said, you know, I really can't remember what happened that day. I know that I told you the story a long time ago. Do you remember it better than I do from my delegate? But I remember it also made the front page of Variety, of course, about all that following week, that November 27th, when they were talking about all the changes that had to be made to various shows as a result of the Kennedy assassination, because there were remarks about Kennedy here and there in various shows, and they mentioned this Mary Martin incident.
And legend has it that that it impacted on Hello, Dolly in a good way, if I can phrase it that way, because the show was out of town, and it gave them some extra time to work on it, because I think they canceled one or two performances.
Cal Channing claims that Gower put a box of Kleenex on the stage and said, look, anybody need to cry, go ahead, but we're working. Somebody else from the show, I don't remember who it was, told me, no, that never happened. Who knows? But
who knows, yeah.
Yeah, but the other thing, though, a lot of people have said, and Carol Channing hates when people say this, that one of the reasons that Hello, Dolly! Was successful is because, boy, do we need it now. You know, that it opened in January, like 7 weeks after the assassination, and everybody needed a good time to buoy them up, just as one of the reasons the Beatles were successful in this country is because the youth of America needed something after having lost the youthful president that that most kids seemed to like. So as a result, yes, no, maybe, but nevertheless, I think Dolly would have made it no matter what happened. But it has been alleged that the Kennedy assassination was a factor in its success.
And wasn't that also hasn't that also been put forth as a possible explanation for the otherwise inexplicable success of Mamma Mia?
Yes, because it was the show after September 11th. Yeah, yeah.
Really, October 18th, 2001.
Yeah.
Some might say that the terrorists won.
Back
to Dogfight. I am not familiar with the work of Pasek and Paul, but I have, as I've said before, I've heard great things about A Christmas Story. And so it did strike me as Dogfight doesn't even start previews till the end of June. So maybe that's why there hasn't been that much buzz lately. And of course, everyone's thinking about the Tonys and the other awards. But considering that it's them and it's Joe Mantello, a book by Peter Duchin or Duchan, by the way, and it's at second stage, which is, you know, does have a great track record. I think that it might turn out to be something really interesting and really newsworthy. I looked it up. It's based on a 1991 film of the same title. I presumably this is, you know, put in a different category of the kind of show that Ben Brantley recently railed against, where, I certainly agree. I don't think there's anything wrong with adapting films as musicals per se.
Not at all.
But when it seems to be done just for commercial reasons, just to raid the catalog and not because the writers seem to have any real creativity reasons for doing so, then yes, that results in the kind of really bad shows that we've seen all too often. But in a case like this, I don't think that applies at all. I don't think this film Dogfight was, certainly was
right,
tremendously commercial or a big hit. And sure. The synopsis of the film fills out the story, I guess, a little more. I guess they wanted to be a little more open in the description on the second stage website. But assuming it's the same, what happens is, if I may read this, 1963, the night before, the 18-year-old Eddie Birdlace Eddie and his friends are shipped to Vietnam. They play a dirty game called Dogfight. All of them seek a woman for a party, and who finds the most ugly one wins a prize. Eddie finds the lonesome pacifist Rose working in a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. She's happy to accompany him, but then she sees through the game. However, by this time, he has already learned to like her, so he follows her home. Will he manage to win her heart despite their differences? Sounds really, really interesting.
I agree.
Well, we hadn't planned on talking about this morning, but there was that announcement about Broadway and Vine this week. Was it this week or last week? Do you guys?
Yeah, certainly recently.
But Broadway and Vine is basically Jed Bernstein, who was the former director of the League, the Broadway mm-hmm. League, is now started a fund that is focused solely on bringing popular Hollywood movies to Broadway. And they're starting off with The Flamingo Kid as their first project.
Can't remember the timing. Do you guys, did that news come out right before or right after Brantley wrote his piece?
I don't know
either. That's a good point.
But it was right around the exact same time. So
it's May 10th. But, Jed Bernstein is a shrewd marketer, and I'm sure that it was somehow planted somewhere that this was going to happen, and Brantley wrote that story either with the purpose Jed Bernstein probably got that to Ben Brantley. Whether or not they told Ben Brantley to write something is another reason, but they know Ben well enough to say that he's going to write something about it if they push the right buttons.
Jed, by the way, is also taking over the Bucks County Playhouse, so it's sort of interesting that he's doing two very disparate things here, because running a little playhouse in Pennsylvania is quite different from doing adaptation of Hollywood movies for the Broadway stage. So these are two very different fingers and two very different pies.
Jed was, after the League, Jed did Long Wharf. Did he?
That doesn't ring a bell. I know he did. Don't Quit Your Night
Trinity
Job.
Rep. Trinity Rep or something like that.
That doesn't sound right to me. And I'm not saying you're wrong.
Yeah,
that doesn't ring a bell.
Jed was running a large regional theater at one point.
I don't recall that at all.
Or am I thinking of somebody else?
I'm not saying you're wrong. Yeah. All I'm saying is it doesn't ring a bell with me. That's the best I can do. So,
well, at any rate, it seems like this initiative is exactly the kind of thing that Ben Brantley was objecting to, and I guess I have to agree. You know, if the initial impetus is commercial, then that can lead to problems. I was just thinking of this the other day because I was listening to 42nd Street, the original cast album, which I hadn't put on my iPod for some reason, and I suddenly realized it wasn't there, and I'm like, gee, I have to remedy that because I love 42nd Street. Mm-hmm. And it really was a terrific, terrific show. And I'm sure that Gower Champion, you know, it occurred to him that this might be a big hit and make a lot of money. But I don't think that was the reason that he did. I mean, I think he did it because he thought he could make a great show, a very entertaining show. Of course, I don't know for sure. I can't get inside his mind, but it you know what I'm saying. It's where it's coming from that I think very often determines how it turns out. Also, it's interesting. There's a theory that when you're adapting something into a musical, especially a film, there's a theory that it's good to choose one that is not perceived as perfect on its own terms.
Sure.
And completely successful and complete in its own way, because what do you have to add to it? Yes, you're adding music, but still, if there is this theory that if you choose something that is interesting but was not a huge commercial success and everyone, not everyone in the world knows it by heart and can recite every line, you know, then you have a greater chance of adding to it in the musical adaptation. But it doesn't sound like they're going to be picking those kinds of films for this initiative. Who knows? Maybe they will. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I was never a big fan of the Mary Poppins score, and while watching the movie again the other night, it struck me that I don't think the score really even necessarily goes with the story very well, because the score really is very sweet, and as I say, I don't think Mary is. But my point is that watching the movie and seeing her take the tape measures of the kids to see how tall they are, and then it describes the kids on the tape measure, and she does it for herself, and it says, practically perfect in every way. Drew and Stiles wrote a fabulous song, one of the best songs certainly in the score, Practically Perfect, a real show song, and just wonderful, and I'm very delighted that happened. So that's an example to me of an improvement. So yes, the famous example always given about you can't improve it is Cyrano de Bergerac, that it's too musical to begin with. It's a musical on its own, even though not a note is sung because of the verse dialogue. But yes, you are better off, no question, not fooling with a masterpiece, because there are too many people who have so many opinions about masterpieces as well. I remember Betty Comden, Adolph Green, in the liner notes of Applause, talking about the fact that there were we were very afraid to go into this property because there are so many people who care for this property like a mother hen. I know mother hen was used in the liner notes as an analogy, and you're gonna get in trouble when you deal with All About Eve, which is generally considered a masterpiece, and Applause, though winning Best Musicals, its star fell very, very quickly. There was a time in the early 80s when Charles Strauss was referred to, it used to say, Charles, parentheses, Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, Annie. As years go on, it's been Charles, parentheses, Bye Bye Birdie, Annie Strauss, you know, so they don't mention Applause anymore. And because yeah. I don't think very many people who felt that, if any, that Applause was an improvement over All About Eve. Do you?
I was
no.
I was wrong about Jed Bernstein. I was confusing him with Edgar Dobie.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he was a long wharf.
That's right. So, but your point about Jed Bernstein having his fingers in Bucks County Playhouse and in this Hollywood and Vine, plus he has his own producing company above the title Entertainment, and he's produced a handful of Broadway shows recently. But I would think that the Bucks County Playhouse, that I think that he is involved from a foundation standpoint. I don't think that he's involved in day-to-day, but I'm not positive about that.
Okay. Yeah, no,
but also the other aspect of it is that being involved in Bucks County is not only a place to, you know, try things out And although that stage is not really big, they can workshop things there. But also that is a very wealthy community where he can raise money.
So I hope so. That theater really had fallen on hard times. The manager was suspicious, yeah, to say the least.
And I was I did Meet Me in St. Louis there. I was John Truitt, the boy next door.
Oh, I can see that.
And I want to tell you that without any ego or arrogance or anything, yeah, you know, absolutely, I'm pretty sure I was the worst John Truitt ever walked the stage.
No kidding.
I don't think there was a John Truitt worse than me ever.
Wow.
How can you be so bad in that part? There's not that much to do.
Well, sure, not only was I boring, but I was untalented as well. So there's
this podcast good should become. We should all confess.
Exactly. You know? Confessions here. So
I can confess. I was just listening to a tape of myself as Linus in the Wagner College production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and I wasn't that good. It really wasn't that good.
Well, I was the worst Lancelot ever to walk the Jersey stage.
My God.
Anyway, so going back to our agenda here, we got off sidetracked with Hollywood, Broadway and Vine. Broadway and Vine, which is going to be this partnership that's bringing the Flamingo Kid in. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there. Also, let's talk about the Road Voters. They're in town this week for a conference with the League and being wined and dined by various Broadway shows. And they're seeing, the Road Voters, where we're talking about Tony Award voters that are from out of town, that are presenters and producers from out of town. And they are in town seeing shows for a week. And how you see 30-some-odd Broadway shows in 1 week is hard to say, but they're an unobjective group that will vote objectively. We'll see what happens.
It's the best parties. I understand Peter and the Starcatcher gave a nice party, and I understand you couldn't get near Christian Borle, and I have a feeling that has much more to do with what used to happen on Monday nights at 10 o'clock than Peter and the Starcatcher, but nevertheless, he was pretty crowded at that party.
And Mr. Riedel says that Death of a Salesman is an all but locked in
Isn't it fascinating how they're lobbying for that award? There's so much of that going on, considering the fact it's not going to run.
They've already said they can't extend. Everybody's got to.
It's amazing to me how much it means to them that that they get that award. In a way, given the fact that they've had the successful run, they've recouped, they've gotten great reviews. They really want that cherry on the top of the sundae. In a way, I feel bad for The Best Man, which I think could win Best Revival in other years, because I think it's a top-notch revival. So, and really, for a lot of us, was a rediscovery of this play that we didn't know was happening. I have to say, I watched the movie The Best Man, and there was a line in it that I would think would be in the play and not in the movie, but it's in the movie and it's not in the play. And I wonder if it was in the play, but has been dropped. And if anybody knows, tell me. But at one point, Henry Fonda, who plays the John Larroquette role, so to speak, hears that his opponent, Cliff Roberts in the movie, Eric McCormack in this revival, they're talking about when he was in college, did he join any questionable groups? And in the movie, I actually had to rewind. I said, did he just say what I thought he said? He says, yes. When I was at Harvard, I was a member of the Hasty Pudding Club. And I thought, wow, the movie audience is expected to know the Hasty Pudding Club. I would think a theater audience would be more likely to know if they would know at all. And I wonder, in fact, if when this revival was put together, that line actually is in Gore Vidal's play script. And they said, we got to cut that. Nobody knows what we're talking about. But it was astonishing for me to hear it in the movie. So, Death of a Salesman wants this prize. I don't know if Mike Nichols needs another Tony, but I just
looked it up. I didn't realize he's won 7.
Yeah. Yeah. He did very well by those Neil Simon plays. Almost every time he was nominated for a Neil Simon play, he won, I think. I mean, it was really pretty amazing there for a while anyway. So
it does seem that this one means a lot to him.
Yeah.
Particularly, I think because he's been quoted a lot about how you know, how the original production really changed his life.
That's true. And, you know, suddenly he's 80 years old. So it's not possible this is the last hurrah, too. He may feel that this is the last thing he does, and he wants to go out with as much of a validation as he can. So, he may work for 10 more years for all we know. But
what do you think the possibilities are of either filming this for a commercial release or to recast it and send it on the road? Maybe that's why they're really looking at it.
Yeah, that could be too. TV, I mean, we already have had two TV adaptations of Death of a Salesman. Doesn't mean we can't have another. But because Lee J. Cobb was filmed in the 60s and the Dustin Hoffman one was as well. It's funny, the original movie of Frederick March never shows up anywhere. And I don't know why that is. There must be some sort of legal hold on it, but it just never shows up. You know, when I was in Alaska, there was a playwriting conference that Arthur Miller was attending. And they had this big array of his movies that they were showing, you know, and I thought, oh, good, I'll finally get to see The Death of a Salesman, Frederick March. It didn't happen. They showed the Dustin Hoffman one. So so I don't know about that, but I think you may be much more likely to be right about a road tour, and why not, you know, get this prize to put this.
Oh, really? I think that's less likely. Just
do
because,
you? Yeah.
Well, because who, I mean, I just assume they couldn't get those. They couldn't get Hoffman and Garfield, and I don't know.
No, it's true. But on the other hand, there have been plenty of star attractions over the years, and damn if I can think of one now, where in New York, it was really a star-studded whatever, and then when it went on the road, they didn't worry about that they just had lesser known people take the roles. And,
yeah, but that was then, this is now, don't you
Well,
think?
Fair. Yeah, yeah, I won't disagree with that.
So back to the Road Voters being in town. Michael, do you think they're going to get a chance to see Josh Young?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I have to be careful here. I mean, I have no idea, obviously, of knowing exactly how often he has missed Jesus Christ Superstar, but I know that he missed the night I saw, which was right around the opening and was a critic's performance. He missed several right around that time. And then I've heard just anecdotally from many other people who've seen the show that they have not seen him. They have seen Jeremy Kushner go on as Judas, whom I saw and who was amazing in the role.
And I saw Josh Young, who's amazing in the role. And so at least whoever you see when you go to Jesus Christ Superstar, you're going to see something amazing. And that's really good. But yes, it would be better if Josh Young showed up for work more than he apparently is doing.
Most recently, a friend of mine saw it last Thursday, and he was out, so I don't know what I was going
to I wonder if we can query the folks at Broadway Understudies to see, you know, if they've got some sort of attendance list, or if, in fact, if Josh Young does win the Tony Award, will Jeremy Kushner go up and accept it for him?
That's right. Thank you for reminding me about that. Is that an actual – it's a website, isn't it?
Well, they were a website, but now I think they're more of a Twitter thing at Broadway Understudies.
I see.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I think you can probably reply them and they'll get back to you with some information, a DM or otherwise. But they do seem to stay up on top of that stuff.
Well, as I said before we started recording, I cannot imagine why the producers did not just say that Jeremy Kushner is the alternate Judas. The role is legendary for being very, very difficult to sing 8 times a week by its very nature. And so of all roles, you know, I do not know why they didn't do that, especially since this is not a case like Porgy and Bess, where we had heard that Audra McDonald requested an alternate for Broadway and it was denied because the producers rightly felt that if she was out, people would probably turn their tickets in. Josh Young is, as of yet, is not a name.
Right. Sure.
You know, so I do not know why they didn't do that. And he would have still been eligible for awards as Elena Roger has been. So I think that was a mistake on their part. I think that would have taken the pressure off you know, because if someone is not listed as having an alternate, then they are expected to do 8 a week, whether
of course,
whether
Michael.
Or not. Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, one must bring up here the fact that as demanding as those roles are, I would say that Tracy Bennett has a much more difficult part in End of the Rainbow. Have you seen it, Michael? It's awfully good. She's amazing. I think you should really go.
Oh, Felicia starting a bar fight here.
No, sorry. Sorry. I cannot support that performance.
All right, let's move on. The Spiegelworld got a show called Empire, and they pitched a tent right in Times Square, and Iazi is pitching a fit. Michael, tell us about your morning walk to work.
Oh yeah, I walk through the theater district almost every morning. Well, every morning on my way to work, and it's interesting. I've reported things about marquees and things that I've noticed, but. Yeah, I was surprised because I hadn't heard a word on Friday, I think it was, to find a picketing outside the site on 45th Street where this tent is going to be erected. I'm not exactly sure. The original thing I heard was that the entrance to it was going to be erected on 45th Street on the site where Barrymore's and Sam's, those restaurants, formerly stood, and that the actual tent itself would be on 46th Street where there is now an art installation of cranes. I'm not really sure what that's all about, but at any rate, and yes, there's picketing, and I read the sign, and it says that it's IATSE and some related unions are picketing Foster Entertainment, which I guess is the production company for Spiegelworld, because they are not using union members. And you know, when IATSE pickets something, well, when any theatrical union pickets, that tends to be big news. So I'm surprised it hasn't broken yet, but maybe it will this week, unless they solve it quickly, which I would think that would be unlikely. So we'll have to see. And the thing that makes the story even more interesting is that these properties in question, the land in question, is owned by the Schuberts, who are not known to engage in union busting activities.
That's fascinating to me, Michael, that piece of land is owned by the Schuberts. It brings up the question, do they own a lot of land? I mean, one knows that they own, umpteen theaters, but land? Do you have any idea if there's any more land that the Schuberts own?
I do not know, but the only reason I know in this case is when Barrymore's and Sam's, when those things closed and were raised, someone who worked there told me that the Schuberts were their landlord. So I still don't understand, parenthetically, not to beat a dead horse, but that seems to have been there was not much foresight shown in those cases because those restaurants were raised like 2 years ago.
Yeah, prematurely. Yeah,
there was the plan was that that entire block was going to come down, including all of the businesses on that block of 8th Avenue between 45th and 46th, and including Frankie and Johnny's Steakhouse is mm-hmm. one of the few remaining old restaurants there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, the Schuberts decided not to give. Why they didn't give a month to month lease to Sam's and Barrymore's is beyond me. I mean that's not unheard of.
Sure.
But they tore them down. They closed them down and then tore them down. On the anticipation that this huge property was going to be built on the site, and it has not, and who knows when it will be now. I haven't heard anything about it lately. So that was too bad, and we lost, two very, very beloved and famous theatrical restaurants that had been
there. I went there plenty of times. Plenty.
Yeah, for years. Barrymore, well, both of them, but Barrymore
both of them,
in particular, yeah.
Yeah.
And and what we have in its place are these chains, for the most part, that people can go to. They might as well be in Omaha,
Sure.
So that made me sad when that happened. And
I want to mention that IATSE stands for the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, in case people don't know what that is.
Oh,
but
yeah.
In fact, I spoke to someone in whose brother is a member the other day, and he didn't know what I was talking about when I said IATSE. And when I finally, or IATSE, and when I finally explained it, he said, oh, I always hear it referred to as Local One. Thank you for clarifying, Peter.
This brings up a good point, though, Schubert's owning, because once upon a time, if you're standing in front of the Imperial Theater, to your right is the music box, right? To your left is a parking garage, but that was a theater once. And I guess it was a Schubert Theater. And maybe that's it. You know, maybe all these theaters that came down during that period in the 40s and 50s when there wasn't landmarking, or even earlier, maybe those were all places that Schubert sold the land as well. And who knows? Maybe they really have much more than just the theaters. It never occurred to me until this came up.
And I guess I should give a disclaimer. I suppose it's possible that they don't own the land, but they just had the lease on the properties, you know, or it could be some arrangement like that. So I'm not 100% sure about that.
Well, we'll have to see what happens here. Perhaps in 2 weeks or so, this will be breaking news on other websites when they talk about this. Have you noticed in the last couple of weeks that, on April 15th, we talked to Stephen Flaherty and had quite a discussion about Lucky Stiff. And this week in the news, it was like breaking news, Lucky Stiff's being made into a movie. You know, we were kind of on top of that. And Michael had mentioned the possible closing of, was it Priscilla that you had mentioned, Michael?
I had mentioned that I had heard that Bring It On was going into the St. James.
That's right.
You did.
It's a handful of those things that were talked and bandied about.
Oh, I guess I did also mention that I had heard that Priscilla was not long for this world. And that brings up the interesting question. What do we think? I guess the assumption is that Annie is going.
I hear it's more than an assumption that Annie is going to take the palace.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That doesn't make it true, but that's what I hear. So,
yeah. All righty. Before we wrap up here, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. That way, you won't miss anything. Of course, you don't have to subscribe in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. You can go to the Broadway Radio website, and you can listen to it directly there. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., where they stream us from the Broadway World radio section. You can also listen to us on from Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry. Lots of different devices support Stitcher, where they just stream our show to you. If you want to get in contact with Peter, Michael, and myself, our contact information is available at BroadwayRadio.com. Our phone number, email address, Twitter, Facebook, all different sorts of ways to get in touch with us. So if, in fact, you have something to say, please don't hesitate to get in touch with us. To wrap up today, Peter and Michael are not much television fans, but my wife and I watch a lot of Grey's Anatomy, and in the season finale this week, they killed off a major character, and I said to myself, I wonder why they killed off this character. I hadn't heard anything about it in the trades or anything like that. And it turns out that Kyler Lee, who plays Dr. Lexi Gray, is going to be coming to Broadway in Sheryl Crow's musical adaptation of Diner. So that's going to be interesting, and that's scheduled, at least rumored to be coming in the fall. So what's going on this week for you guys? Anything special we should talk about? We're all just getting ready for... Peter, any update on the Theater World Awards venue?
It looks like, that's the best I can say, it's going to be at the Belasco. Okay. That isn't set in stone, but it's as close to set in stone as possible.
Have a date?
June 5th, 2 o'clock. Yeah, we do know that. That's definitely going to happen. And yes, I'll be emceeing again. And Tony Sheldon from Priscilla is going to present. So does David Alan Greer from Porgy and Bess. And Leslie Uggams is going to present. I do know those for sure. I don't know many others. I do know our crackerjack team of Mary Bodasson and Aaron Oestreich do a great job in getting the people. God love them for doing the job that they do. So it's still happening. I got my opening jokes and my closing jokes, so I'm happy. This week I'm seeing Cock. on Tuesday at 8. I hope it's 8 and not 7. And then, as I mentioned, I'm going to Rochester to judge a contest out there of young teenage kids vying for scholarships. So that's going to be nice. And while I'm out there, I'm seeing a production of Company at the Geva Theater, G-E-V-A, which means Genesee Valley, which is where Rochester is. And so I'm really looking forward to that. I've only been in the lobby of that theater, but I've never seen a show there. So I'm really looking forward to it. And, of course, Company. Michael, I don't know if you know or remember this, but the first time I ever met you was at a production of Company. Did you know that?
No, remind me.
You were with Kevin McInerney. It was that opening doors company that used to perform on 42nd Street Theater Row.
Yeah.
So that's the first time I ever met you. It takes us full circle anyway. So I'll look forward to that. So that's how I'm spending my week.
Michael, what's going on with you?
Well, I don't have much theatrically coming up, but I am going to the Urban Stages benefit tomorrow night at the Boathouse in Central Park. They're honoring the Gilman and Gonzalez Falla Foundation for their very, very staunch support of new musicals. They are a terrific couple. Yeah. And they're also honoring several composers, including Doug Cohen and Joe Iconis, who are real up-and-comers. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know when my next show is.
You know, so much of the world just stops in between Tony Award announcements for nominations and the actual event. So
we insist.
But it was interesting. Did Harvey just go into previews or did it open?
Yeah.
It just went into previews.
Yes.
It didn't open. So because I glanced at Broadway Stars the other morning and it said Harvey went into previews and I went, oh, I got to check that. Did we make a mistake on Broadway Stars? And no, it actually did go into previews and the system did work. So,
oh, good.
Which reminds me, I have to write an article about why I do think Harvey deserved the Pulitzer Prize, even though it was the same year as the Glass Menagerie. Wow. I really and truly believe that in the core of my soul. And the Glass Menagerie is one of my all-time favorites, but I understand the prize. So that's an article I've got to write.
Well, I'll be interested to read that.
Because you don't believe it either. Huh?
Oh, I don't know. Harvey is one of those cases for me where I have never read or seen it in any form whatsoever. I just always missed it. So I'm going to begin going in totally cold. And
interesting.
I love that. I love that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
That's a great joy as well. So.
All right, so I guess next week we might start talking about what we think about what's going to happen with the Tony Awards. We still have to get together and figure out if next week or the week after is a better week to talk about that. But so on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Your breath before you speak in case it's halitosis.
Of course, you can say it backwards, which is Suyo Ekadaliap, Zekatsilagar, Philocrepus.
She may be tricky, but she's bloody good.
So when the cat has got your tongue, there's no need for dismay. Just summon up this word and then you've got a lot to say.
Pick out those 18 consonants and 16 vowels as well. Then put them in an order that is very hard to spell.
S.
S.
U.
U.
P.
P.
E.
E.
R. C A L I F R A G I L I S T I C E X P I A L I D
O C I O U S
Smarty pants.